First of all, it's nice to be here. Any suggestions what you want me to talk about this evening? Because in West Australia, that sometimes, instead of just talking what I want to talk about, sometimes it's nice to have some suggestions. Any suggestion what you want me to talk about this evening? I can pass my word, you like.
I'm easily satisfied. Yeah.
No suggestions. Okay, we might as well go then. Okay. It's interesting actually that the chant which was done at the beginning there was the words of Brahma Sahampati to the Buddha after his enlightenment. And basically, if Brahma Sahampati, who's like a Brahma, is like equivalent to the Buddhist idea of a god. If Brahma Sahampati hadn't have invited the Buddha to teach, the Buddha would never have taught. So actually all of Buddhism, all the Dhamma, would have to say thank you to Brahma Sahampati for that. So as one of my novices once said, thank God for Buddhism. It's literally. Thank Brahma Sahampati for Buddhism. But the Dhamma is... It is a very great thanks for it, because the Dhamma, the teaching of the Buddha, are just so wonderful. They create so much happiness, so much peace, so much guidance in our world, that Buddhism is growing so strong that monks like Ajahn Pasano, Ajahn Amaro, and all the other teachers there have to work so hard actually to keep up with the demand of Buddhist teachings. And the reason why that Buddhist teachings are becoming so popular is because they're rational, because they work, they're profound, and they produce the goods. Which is why these days, that when we teach Buddhism, you know that sometimes we talk about basic Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths. What are those Four Noble Truths? Too often in the Western world, actually, probably in the Asian world, first of all, they keep on talking about the Four Noble Truths as suffering. The cause of suffering. The end of suffering. And the way leading to the end of suffering. And usually that's all people hear. Suffering. They have enough of that in their daily lives. They don't want to come to a temple and spend their Saturday night listening to more suffering. So, it's part of, especially our tradition, is to keep the core of the teachings, but present them in a modern way. And so whenever, actually for the last 15 years, whenever I've been teaching the Four Noble Truths, I haven't taught suffering and cause of suffering and that stuff. Instead, I've rearranged it. Based on the understanding that the Third Noble Truth, the end of suffering, otherwise known as Nibbana, and the Buddha said that Nibbana is the ultimate happiness, Nibbanang Paramang Sukhang. So I've changed it around. I started with the Third Noble Truth, first of all. And so when I teach the Four Noble Truths, it's the truth of happiness. The cause of happiness. Sometimes there's a lack of happiness. And why there's no happiness? And straight away when you talk about happiness instead of suffering, people listen. And not only is it a rearranging but keeping the core teachings, it's basically what we call these days marketing, but it also makes a great point. That Buddhism is not just about suffering, it's about the opposite of happiness. And that is actually the reason why people become Buddhists and why they practice Buddhism. Because it promises you happiness by showing what the cause of happiness is and that why we're unhappy sometimes, unhappiness is. But putting it that way shows that this path of Buddhism, when you practice it properly, gets you happier and happier and happier. That's what it's supposed to do, and that's what it does do. And one of the core suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Dhammacetiya Sutta, was where King Pasenadi, who was one of the Buddha's chief supporters, just at the end of his life, He went to the Jetavana Monastery, the Jeta Grove Monastery, to see the Buddha. He bowed at the Buddha's feet, and the first thing he said was how much he enjoyed going to this monastery. Because in that monastery, all the monks were smiling and happy. And the Buddha said, yes, great king, that's as it is when people are meditating and getting insights. So that's what you'd expect. For people ending suffering, they should be happier and happier and happier. And that was important to me in my early life as a lay Buddhist, because I decided I would be I would refuse to be taught by a miserable monk. If the monk or the teacher wasn't happy, they should get their own act together before they start teaching anybody else. And the reason I went to Thailand to become a monk was because of all those teachers I saw in London when I was growing up as a Buddhist. Zen monks, Tibetan monks, Sri Lankan monks, Thai monks, Western monks. It was the Thai monks who smiled the most. So that said, wait, maybe those guys have got their act together. They know what Buddhism is, because it should be easing suffering. In other words, getting greater happiness. And that is what the gradual path is all about. The gradual path of easing suffering, getting more and more happiness. So the more you practice this path, you should get happier and happier and happier. Bliss upon bliss, ecstasy upon ecstasy, until you really bliss out your mind and you go out of samsara in this big blaze of ecstasy, which is a great way of going. Which is the arahat. So, today I'm going to talk to you about happiness and why sometimes we're unhappy. A story which comes to mind is that one day I was counseling these two Thai ladies. Monks are very sought after counselors, even more so than lay people. And you know why? It's because we're cheap. We don't charge. That makes us very popular. But on this particular occasion, they were sisters, these two Thai ladies. And, you know, when you're counseling, you ask the first one, what's your problem, madam? And her problem was her husband. She was having a terrible time in her relationship. She wanted to get rid of her husband. She had enough. She was fed up. I tried to tell her, this was some advice, which is, some of these stories are from my book, by the way, Open the Door of Your Heart, Available from Wisdom, very cheap. Much cheaper than going to a therapist. But anyway, one of these stories was, this Singaporean disciple, she told me that when she was married, her father took her new husband aside to give him some advice. He told her new husband, his new son-in-law, you probably love my daughter right now. He said, of course. She's so beautiful and so charming. Everything she does is so lovely. Oh, she's the most beautiful, wonderful girl in the world. And the husband, the father-in-law rolled his eyes and says, yeah, that's what it's always like when you get married. But remember this. In about a couple of years' time, you will start to see the faults and defects in my daughter. You can't see them now, but you know, 2 years you'll see them. But always remember this. If she never had those faults and defects to begin with, son-in-law, she would have married someone much better than you. And the moral of that story... it's very true. The moral of that story is, whoever you're married to, you should be very grateful because... So I told stories about that to this lady, but she wouldn't buy it. So she wanted to get rid of her husband. So I tried my best. So then I turned to her sister. What's your trouble? And her sister's trouble was that, you know, she was single and she couldn't find a partner. You know how it is to find a partner in this world, a nice sensitive guy. And so she was worried about being single, and, you know, a solution came to me. So one lady had a husband she didn't want, and her sister wanted one. It's obvious. But they wouldn't have any of it. So then instead I started teaching Dharma instead. And I told the first sister, who had a husband she didn't want, I said, "Madam, you have got what we call in Dharma, in Buddhism, you've got married person suffering. Married person's dukkha. Now if you get rid of your husband, we guarantee you won't have married person suffering any longer. You have the same suffering your sister's now got, called single person suffering." And you sister, you've got single person suffering, and it's sure, when you get a husband, a nice guy, you won't have that suffering anymore. You'll have married person suffering. And isn't that the case in life? So often we think if we change things, we won't have any suffering. But really all you're doing is changing one type of suffering for another type of suffering. When I was a young monk, I was very upset at the senior monks. You know what it's like in our monasteries? The senior monks usually get all the best food. At the end of the line, you know, we'd be lucky if we get much at all. You remember those days, Ajahn Pasama? And I started thinking, these guys at the top of the line, you know, these are probably already enlightened. You know, nice, delicious food is wasted on them. They've got no desires and craving. But me, I still got craving. So if it's only fair that the younger monks should get the best food. Not only that, but, you know, as a big monk, you get the fattest cushions. And at the end of the line, sometimes, you're lucky here, you've got a mat at all, but in Thai we have to sit on the bare concrete. And I thought, that's also unfair, because the senior monks, we've always, you know, the senior monks are the fattest. They've got what we call natural upholstery on their bottoms. So really they should give the fat cushions to the junior monks. Not only that, there's all the junior monks, we had to do all the work. Well, those senior monks, we just sat around all day talking to people. Really unfair. And it's always the senior monks' ideas of what work we do. They never did anything. So I was really upset, thinking if we must start a monk union for better rights. But when I started complaining, someone said, "You have got what we call junior monk suffering." So if there's any, you got any anagarikas here, you've got anagarika suffering. When you become a monk, you won't have anagarika suffering any longer. You won't have to drive the vehicle, you don't have to cook, you don't have to make breakfast in the morning, you've got what's called junior monk suffering. And now I'm a senior monk. Oh, it's so tough being a senior monk. Got to talk to people all day. You have to sort of solve all their problems for them, marriage problems, kids problems. And we became monks to get away from all of that. It's really unfair. So we've got what we call senior monk suffering. So the point of that story is that whatever you've got, if you change things, do you really get rid of the suffering, or is it just changing one type of suffering for another type of suffering? For those of you who want to become nuns, it's sure when you be ordained as a nun, you won't have layperson suffering anymore, you have nun suffering. So when you do that, just forget about the suffering and just say, this is part of our life, this is how we're going to start living. Instead of complaining, we just allow it to happen. You know that time Ajahn Pasana, when Ajahn Chah was building his big Uposatha hall? I don't know if you were there at the time, but just after he built the big hall on top of this mound of earth, there was a lot of earth left over. I remember this story, I don't know if you remember it, that afterwards we had to move this earth. Because Ajahn Chah said all this earth was left over, it was in the wrong place. So we had to move it. 3 days of hard work. And those days, you know, we just had one meal a day. And it wasn't all that nutritious. And it was usually very early in the morning, so by about 9:30 we were working. Having to shovel this earth in wheelbarrows in the hot, steaming, mosquito-ridden jungle monasteries of northeast Thailand. It was hard work. But in those days, you know, we had faith. This was for your teacher. You were really inspired. So after 3 days, I remember, we'd finished moving this earth. And I thought, wow. We used to work about 10 o'clock. We used to, or 9:30, we used to have these lanterns outside so we can work even in the dark. With no food at lunch or in the evening. It was really tough work. But at the end of the the work. You thought, ah, at last we were finished. Now tomorrow we can have a rest. Do some meditation. But remember that night, Ajahn Chah went off to another monastery. And the following morning, Ajahn Liam, who came here recently, he was the second monk, so he took charge. And he said the earth was in the wrong spot. So we had another 3 days, we had to move it. I still had faith. Working from 9:30 till about 9:30 at night, in the hot, steaming, mosquito-ridden jungles of northeast Thailand. It was tough, but we did it. After we finished, Ajahn Chah came back. He got all the monks together and said, I thought I told you to put the earth in this spot. You put it over there, move it. So another 3 days of hard work, malnourished in the hot, steaming, mosquito-ridden jungles of northeast Thailand. It loomed in front of me, and by this time, I lost my faith. This was not on. This was not fair. Why can't these monks decide where they want this bloody earth? The reason I swear sometimes in talks is because the Vinaya says that the Dhamma should be taught in the local language. And I'm in America now, so. But I was really upset. I was really suffering. It was one of those times when you used to swear, but you always used to swear in English. So the Thai monks could never understand what you were saying. But of course they could see your body language and you were upset. So one of them came up to me. As well as occasions they said something which really changed the way you did things. They said, thinking about it is the hard part, pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part, pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. And of course the light went on in my mind and they were right, so I stopped complaining and just pushed the wheelbarrow. And as soon as I stopped thinking about it and complaining, it became very easy. And so for the rest of my life, whatever you have to do, don't think about it, just do it, and life is very easy. Our problem is we think so much, and it is a completely different ball game. When you just do things rather than think about it, it becomes so easy. But if you are going to think about it, at least think about it in a positive way. One of the first stories in my book, one of my most popular stories, the reason I put it in the book, in the first page, was the story of my two bad bricks. This particular story goes like this, and I'm sure Ajahn Pasno can relate to this, because when you first go to a Western country outside of in Thailand, sometimes you do have to work, but a lot of times the lay people do all the work for you. You just have to supervise, which is very nice. But as soon as you go to the West, no one supervises, or no one actually does the work. You have to both supervise and do the work. And we were so poor when we first got our monastery. We were in debt. And so we could not afford to have a builder. We had to do the building work ourselves. All we could afford just was the building material. So I had to work. I had to learn how to mix concrete and to lay bricks and to be a carpenter and a plumber as well. You had to learn everything. And before I was just a high school teacher and a theoretical physicist. You weren't used to working with your hands all that much. So now you had to learn how to lay bricks. Laying bricks may seem easy. In Western Australia we have lots of termites, so we can't really use wood. Everything has to be out of concrete or bricks or iron. So I had to learn how to lay bricks. You may think it is easy, but it is not. When you put a piece of a brick on top of the cement mortar, you have to make it level. And it never is level. One corner is always too high, so you have to tap that one down. As soon as you tap one corner down, another corner goes up. As soon as you tap that second corner up down, it goes out of line. So you tap it back into line again, and the first corner comes up again. It is very frustrating sometimes, if you're a perfectionist like I was. So, I didn't care how long it took, I was going to make sure every brick was perfect before I went on to the next one. I had time, I wasn't being paid, so who cares? When I finish my first brick wall, like anyone would do, you stand back to admire your handiwork. And that's when I saw them. I don't know how I had missed these two bad bricks, but all the rest of the bricks were nice and level. These two bricks were at an angle. They spoiled the whole wall. I tried to scrape them out, scrape the mortar out, to remove them so I can put them in again. Now it's a terrible angle. I don't know how I missed it. But all the cement mortar was hard. So I asked the other monk I was with, Ajahn Jacaro, if we could buy some dynamite so I could blow it up and start again. But he wouldn't let me. So I was stuck with this terrible brick wall. It looked so ugly. I'd ruined the first thing, and worse, everybody could see it. I suffered so much because of that wall. Every time I thought about it, I thought, oh, what had happened? Why did that happen? And every time a visitor came, I would try to be the one who showed them around so I could always take them somewhere else so they couldn't see my terrible brick wall. I was also embarrassed. But one day a person came and they saw that wall. And they said what a beautiful wall that was. I couldn't believe what they said. I actually asked them, "Sir, are you visually impaired?" "Well, you left your glasses in the car. Can't you see those two bad bricks?" And they said, "Yes, I can see the two bad bricks. But I can also see the 998 good bricks as well," they said. And that changed my whole perception of that wall and of many other things in life. It was a strange thing. For 3 months, I would only see two bricks, my mistakes. Every time I thought of that wall, those were the only two bricks I thought of. Every time I went past it, those were the only two bricks my eyes would go to. I learned some psychology of the human mind, how much we focus on our faults. I needed someone to point out to the left and the right, above and below, were good bricks, beautiful bricks, lovely bricks. Once I could see the whole wall, it did not look so bad anymore. Still there somewhere. Can't find it these days, but it's there somewhere, I know. Why is that the case that in our life, sometimes we make one or two mistakes, and that is all we see? Why is it that some kids commit suicide? One or two bad bricks is all they see. And it's meant to destroy their whole life. If only I could see to the left and the right, above and below, those two things which are so-called mistakes, which disappoint them. There's beautiful bricks. When we see the whole picture, we can be more at peace with life, even see its beauty. Another story which illustrates this very same point. When I was giving a talk in Malaysia some years ago, at question time a lady put up her hand and asked this question. She said, "My husband has just lied to me. I can't trust him anymore. Should I get divorced?" So I asked her, first of all, what she was doing. And she was actually a teacher of math. So I saw an opportunity to answer her question. I asked her how long he would be married to this guy. She said, "About 3 years." So I said, 3 years, that's roughly about 1,000 days you've been married to this guy. And let's assume, because you're a teacher of math, I'm going to do some statistics with you. Let's assume that on average he said 20 things to you every day, on average, which could be right, which could be wrong, which could be truthful or could be lies. So since you've been married, he said 20,000 things to you, and now he's lied for the first time. According to probability theory, that means the next time he opens his mouth is a 20,000 to 1 chance he's telling the truth. What do you mean you can't trust him? That's pretty trustworthy to me, 20,000 to 1. But why is it that we think someone has lied once, that we cannot trust them. Why do we want to destroy that wall because of one bad prick? Yeah, I agree with you. So the point of our story is sometimes our perceptions are so skewed that sometimes we can destroy relationships, we can destroy our happiness, we can destroy many things because our perceptions are skewed from the truth. We just don't see things in a rational, logical, wise way. We have to see things in a good way. We tend to be more easy to live with ourselves and live with other people. The end of that particular story occurred when I was giving a talk at a cancer group, which I go to every twice a year. Because a lot of people get a lot of benefit from cancer and Buddhism. It's amazing. Sometimes I know some people have actually got cured through meditation. There's this one guy. He had, his name is George. He's one of the people who keep coming to our monastery. This old English guy. He's a very heavy smoker. He had lung cancer. He went to, this is a true story, not a joke. Oncologist told him that both lungs, he had the x-ray, both lungs were full of cancer, lung cancer. Inoperable, because you can't take both lungs out. You need something left to breathe. And the doctor said, we can give you chemotherapy, radiation therapy. Don't know what it would do, but you know, usually in this particular case, it would just extend your life by 2 or 3 months, that's all. But if you want us to do that, we're fine to do that. Go back to your family, talk it over with them, see what you want to do. So he did that and came back in 2 weeks. He decided just to let nature take its course. What's the point of going through this type of very uncomfortable therapy if it's only going to extend your life by such a short time? The oncologist decided to do another x-ray to see how the disease had progressed. And when George went into the room, the oncologist, the specialist, was looking at the new x-ray, shaking his head. And George thought that it had got much worse. He was so afraid, but courageous. He said, okay, doc, tell me how many days I've got left. It's got worse, hasn't it? And the doctor was shaking his head and said, I'm not shaking my head because it's got worse. I'm shaking my head because it's completely disappeared. Just within 2 weeks. He said, what the hell have you been doing, George? And George said, meditating. The doctor said, carry on. In 2 weeks, his cancer completely disappeared. Sometimes that happens. So the point is that in these groups, that sometimes that meditation, lessening your stress, giving us a bit of ease, not thinking about things so much, actually eases the problem. But this particular cancer group I was teaching, after I told the story of the brick wall, this builder came up to me. And he said, don't worry so much about you making mistakes, because in the building industry, everybody makes mistakes, even bricklayers. But then he let me into a secret. He said, but in the building industry, when we make a mistake, we call it a feature. And we charge our clients an extra $2,000 or $3,000 for it. What a beautiful ending that is. If you've got a house or an apartment with a feature, it started as a mistake. And isn't that very beautiful, where we can take the mistakes of life and turn them into features? It's a beautiful way of looking at life. Even beautiful way of looking at Buddhism. So whatever happens to you in life, nothing is wasted. We can always make use of everything in life, even the mistakes in life. When we see that wall, we can embrace everything. And this is actually a part of ending suffering. It's like learning how to be at peace and be content with things instead of always fighting things, instead of thinking about things. Sometimes we think, okay, if I get rid of that wall, I haven't got bad wall suffering, but you get another type of suffering instead. So why not be content and end suffering completely? It is the contentment which is the way to ease suffering. In this little book, one of the key stories, which I put in that book, which is actually the title of the Australian edition. The American edition of the book is called Who Ordered This Truckload of Dung? Because you need an edge to sell a book in the United States. But in Australia and Europe, it's called Opening the Door of Your Heart. That would not sell in the US. Too mushy. But however, that story is one of the most important stories in the book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. And it's a powerful story. It's all about metta. And the story actually originated when I was about 13 or 14 year old boy. And my father took me aside one afternoon. He told me something, again, which changed my life. He said, "Son, whatever you do, wherever you go, always remember this. The door of my house will always be open to you." I always remembered that, but I couldn't understand it. It was a bit strange because his house, where we lived, he was a very poor man because he was always quite sickly, was what I think in the US you call government-assisted housing. It was only a small apartment. There's hardly anything in it because it was very poor. In fact, we always used to not be afraid of burglars, even leave our door open, hoping a burglar would come in, take pity on us and leave something. So it couldn't have been his house he was leaving the door open to. What he's really saying, and I worked this out when I was in Thailand as a young monk, was, "Son, whatever you do in your life, the door of my heart is open to you. You're my son and that's enough." That was a very beautiful expression of unconditional loving kindness. Didn't matter what I did, where I went. I was his son and that was enough. And I've used that, not just in my relations with other people, but also with my meditation and also with my relation to myself. Because there has to come a time in each person's life, in the quietness and privacy of their mind, when they say to themselves, "Me, whoever I am, whatever I've done, the door of my heart is open to me as well. Come in." Because you'll find there's a part of you you've rejected and kept outside. The part you're not proud of, the part which you feel guilty about, or the part which creates so much suffering in your life. Open the door of your heart means you allow that to come in. The door of my heart's open to all of me, no matter what I've ever done, no matter who I am. It's a wonderful sense of embracing any bad bricks in your life, of allowing it to come in, accepting and being at peace with your history and with your pain and with your happiness, allowing everything to come in. It's a very beautiful way of saying no more ill will, no more grief, no more guilt, of being free. It is a path of unconditional loving kindness towards oneself and even towards life itself. However, too often people don't understand that. And even when I say it, sometimes people fall asleep. So I'm going to have some audience participation. Now I'm going to ask you a question. Give you a test, so listen carefully. If you heard this story before, you must keep quiet. Please don't spoil my fun. This is the story of the seven monks practicing metta meditation, loving kindness. A long time ago, in a jungle, in a realm, a long way from here, there were seven monks practicing loving kindness, metta meditation. The door of my heart is open to all beings, no matter who they ever are, unconditional. Now I'm going to tell you who these seven monks were, so listen carefully, this is important. The seven monks was the head monk, his brother was number two, his best friend was number three. The fourth monk was the enemy, just they never got on together, the head monk and the enemy. The fifth monk was a very old monk. He was so advanced in years, he could die at any day. The next monk was a very sick monk. He was so ill that no one knew who would die first, the old monk or the sick monk. Both were at the end of their life. And lastly, monk number 7 was the useless monk. Even though they allowed him into the cave to meditate, whenever he closed his eyes, he'd begin snoring. He couldn't remember the chanting, and when he did, he'd chant off-key, and his robe was always falling off. Whenever I say this, I make sure my robe is okay. He was a useless monk, but they tolerated him. Every monastery has their useless monk. I have my useless monk. Do you have yours here as well? But don't tell me who it is. So these were the 7 monks. And one day this gang of thieves, this band of robbers, found the cave in the jungle where they were practicing their loving kindness meditation. And they thought what a wonderful cave that was, as a hideout where they could escape from the police and also put all their loot, all their takings, what they stole. But they could not let the monks stay there. They wanted to kill all the monks, so no one would tell the police where this cave was situated. But the head monk was a good talker, like most abbots. Don't ask me how he did this, but he managed to convince the head of the thieves to let all the monks go, except one. The thieves insisted on killing one of the monks as a warning to all the rest to keep quiet. And that's the best the head monk could do. So the head monk, the abbot, had this terrible choice to make. Who would be sacrificed so the rest could go free? And now I'm going to ask you, who you thought the head monk chose? Now before you answer the question, I'll go through the list again. Listen very carefully. There was the head monk himself, there was his brother, there was his best friend, there was his enemy, he never liked him at all. And then there was the old monk who was about to die, as with the sick monk, who was at the end of his life. And last there was the useless monk, who throughout his whole existence had done nothing worthwhile for anybody. So, who did the head monk choose? Any idea? Someone said himself, if you agree with that, please put your hand up. Have the courage of your convictions. Okay, thank you. You are all wrong. Which is why I do this little exercise. I'm a sadist at heart. That is the wrong answer. Any other suggestions? The oldest monk? No. The useless monk? He usually gets number 2. Now he's number 3. That's wrong also. Yes? Sick monk? No. I will stop your torture now. The answer is, if ever a monk asks a question like this, you'll be very wise not to answer, because they're always trick questions. But there's a point to this. The answer was, he could not choose. His love, his metta towards his brother, was exactly the same, no more, no less, than his love towards his best friend. No more, no less, than his love towards his enemy, the sick monk, the old monk, even the useless monk. He loved them all equally. Unconditional loving kindness does not distinguish between one person and the next. But more importantly, his love towards all those 6 monks was no more, no less, than his love towards himself. Even in the Christian tradition, we have the golden rule to love your neighbor as yourself. Does not mean to love your neighbor more than yourself, certainly not less. To love your neighbor as yourself means to love yourself as your neighbor. That's why the head monk could not choose. He had metta equally towards himself and all others. And the reason I ask this question is because it always happens in the Western world, people say he sacrificed himself. Why do people say that? Because it reveals a lack of metta towards oneself. We are harder on ourselves than on any other person. more critical, less forgiving. That's why I tell that story, because it reveals something very important, how hard it is to give metta towards ourselves. If you can truly treat yourself as you treat other beings, then you're on the path to enlightenment. So it's not just may all other beings be happy and well. Metta, loving kindness, unconditionally, you also count. So which is why that sometimes people in relationships, sometimes the relationships are very dysfunctional. I was saying, I think yesterday, that in Buddhism we have the two types of Buddhism, Hinayana and Mahayana. Hinayana just is mostly concerned about itself. This is its own enlightenment, its own happiness. Mahayana is just not concerned about yourself at all, concerned about others. They say in a marriage it's usually one Hinayana partner and one Mahayana partner. It's usually the man is Hinayana, just concerned about what he can get out of the marriage. And the wife is usually just concerned about the other. Both are dysfunctional. That's why marriages, relationships don't last. When one person thinks, what can I get out of this? Their needs. Or when the other thinks, what can I give? Both are very dysfunctional. Instead of Hinayana and Mahayana, the right way in the marriage or any relationship, it's not me, not them. It's what's between us. It's a relationship. What's in the middle. When I understand what loving kindness truly means, it's our relationship to ourselves, our relationship to other beings. It's what's in between is the most important. I even say that for one's meditation. Whether you're watching the breath or whatever you're watching in your meditation, the object of your meditation is not so important as how you're watching it. What's between you and your meditation object? What's between your mind and what you're experiencing now? That is the heart of meditation. If you put your mindfulness there and put peace between you and any object, or put loving kindness towards you between you and any object, to say, whatever you're experiencing now, the door of my heart's open to this, unconditionally, then you know what contentment and peace truly is. And how, with that sort of attitude, the mind becomes very still, very happy, and very brilliant. This is actually where we should put our attention. Too often, we're either not concerned about ourselves or concerned about the other. And this is why we never get anywhere in our life of peace, happiness and wisdom. There was one time when I was a monk in the north of Thailand. It was a very interesting occasion which taught me about what letting go is and what trying to let go is. Because on this particular occasion I found this beautiful, perfect monastery in the north of Thailand. I was by myself. No one was really interested in asking any questions. It was high in the mountains, there's a cave, the village was just over the hill, so I couldn't see any houses from the monastery, hear no noise. The only traffic was once a week, one car would come up to actually to deliver some goods and to take produce from the mountain down. If you weren't looking, you would not see it, and that was the only traffic you would ever see. So it was a perfect situation. This monastery was abandoned. No one was there, and it was very easy to maintain. So I had this incredible period of solitude. So I was meditating all day. But after a few weeks, my meditation started to fall apart. I couldn't stop thinking. And what I was thinking was what I call unmonkish thoughts, if you know what I mean. I started to think about old girlfriends, relationships, sex, and I didn't want to think about those things. I tried to stop them, but they wouldn't stop. The worst thing was I had no other monk to go and talk to, so I was by myself. So I just tried even harder to suppress those things, but it just got worse and worse. And one day it got so bad, I went to the main hall, bow to the Buddha and ask for some inspiration to please help me with my meditation. And what came up into my mind, maybe because I was a Westerner, why not make a deal? That's what Westerners do. So the deal was this. For most of the day, please allow me to watch the breath. But from 3 to 4 every afternoon, you can think whatever you want. Anything goes. Sex, relationships, the most deviant fantasy, 3 to 4, anything goes. That's fair enough, I thought. If the mind wanted to think those things, 3 to 4, let the time behave. But it never worked the way I expected. The mind was still as wanton as ever. I tried to control my mind. It kept, you try to watch the breath, these thoughts would just come in and just burst through all your defenses. And you'd stop again. No, I don't want to think those things. They keep coming in. And by 3 o'clock, I was so tired fighting my mind. But I had to keep the other half of the bargain. I went to my hut. I leant against the wall because I was just so tired and aching. Put my feet out and said, okay, now you can think whatever you want. Anything goes. And for the next hour, my mind just watched the breath go in and watched the breath go out without any problems. I learned an important lesson. The difference between letting go and doing letting go. And there's a big difference there. So now whatever comes up, I say, whatever's happening, the door of my heart's open to you. Come in. And when you don't fight, when you make peace, you have peace. You know, the last time I was in the San Francisco area was in 1969, when I had more hair than I have now, and hippie beads and green velvet trousers. In those days, I kept on going around saying, make peace, not war, make peace, not war. And I haven't changed. Even now, with your mind, make peace, not war, make peace, not war. So when you're meditating, do you make peace or do you make war? If you make war with your mind, you have what we call collateral damage. Samadhi headache, frustration, despair, I can't meditate. So stop making war with your mind, make peace. Open the door of your heart to every moment. You'll find that that lacking of fighting creates enormous peace. And that peace creates stillness. And that stillness creates joy and happiness. The Buddha said that the path to end suffering, the path of nibbana, is ending craving, not having more craving. Being able to meditate with no expectation, with no craving, with freedom. If you do this, you understand the path of deep meditation. You also understand how to live happily together in a relationship. You also understand just how to be at peace with all aspects of your life, even old age, sickness and death. Even when you're sick and old, you say, the door of my heart is open to the sickness. The door of my heart is open to the death process. You make peace with every moment of your life. Not war. When you don't fight, when you don't have so much stress, you have more freedom and even more possibility of healing. One of the old stories which is in the Udana is the story of the anger-eating demon. It's a beautiful story about life which goes like this. One day, in a realm a long way away, there was an emperor who was away on business, and while he was away, this terrible monster came into the emperor's palace. He was so ugly, so smelly, so disgusting, that all of the soldiers and guards who were supposed to be looking after this place froze in terror, allowing this terrible demon to walk right into the palace and sit on the emperor's chair, on his throne. As soon as it did that, the guards came to their senses and said, get out of here, you don't belong. Who do you think you are? Get out! At those few unkind words, this demon grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, and his language got even worse. And that just made them more upset. They got out of their swords, they made threats. But every unkind word, deed or thought, the demon grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more offensive. And this had been going on a long time when the emperor came back. And when he went into his room, in his throne room, he saw this incredibly big monster who was so frightening and terrible. Even in DreamWorks, Steven Spielberg could not imagine something so frightening. And he was so ugly and so smelly, the stench coming off him would even make a maggot throw up. And the language was terrible. But the reason why this guy was the emperor, because he was smart. He knew what to do. So straight away he said, "Welcome. Thank you for coming to visit me. Why have you waited so long? Has anyone got you anything to drink? We have coffee? How about latte?" "I can ring out Starbucks straight away and get you some. How about something to eat? Do you want a pizza? Monster size, of course." And in those few kind words, this demon grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And all the people in the palace realized their mistake. They'd been fighting this demon with ill will. So instead, they started being kind. One of them came up to this demon and gave him a foot massage. The other one massaged the back of his neck, because with a big ugly head like that, you get a lot of shoulder pain. So they're so kind. Every kind act, this demon grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And they started laying on the kindness so much. Well, after a short while, this demon was back to the size when he first came in. But they never stopped. They kept on being so kind. The demon grew smaller and smaller, and then one more act of kindness, and this demon vanished completely away. And when the Buddha told that story, he said, "We call that an anger-eaten demon. You give them anger, and they get much worse." I told that story in marriage counseling. I say, sometimes your husband is an anger-eating demon. Look at anger. They get taller, so they get uglier, and the smell and the language gets much worse. A boss at work can be an anger-eating demon as well. Even sometimes an adult can be an anger-eating demon. No, they're not in this monastery. But certainly some of your mind states are anger-eating demons. Get out of here, you don't belong. You can say to some of the things which happen in your mind. And you'll find it get worse and worse and worse. Some cancers are anger-eating demons. They are born of stress. You say, "Get out of here, you don't belong." And they get worse. So with many of the anger-eating demons, especially what happens in your meditation, how about welcoming them with loving kindness? So welcome, sloth and torpor. Thank you for coming to visit me. Welcome, restlessness. The door of my heart's open to you. You'll find that many of those states are anger-eating demons. And when you give them loving kindness, peace, instead, you'll find they get smaller and smaller until they completely vanish away. That is how we get rid of the negative states, both in our mind and in our life, and then we can live happily ever after, which is a path of happiness. And I better shut up soon, otherwise you're not going to be very happy with me, because I've already talked for 1 hour now. Are there any questions about what I've been saying? Any questions? I have to talk. Okay, can I tell that story again before you ask a question? Because to get questions, I told this story last night at Spirit Rock. Imagine you get lots of questions. Because the Buddha taught in the Mahakamavibhaga Sutta the karmic reason why some people will be reborn wealthy in the next life, and what karma you have to do to be reborn poor in your next life. And also, this is why I'm putting my head down now, you know why I'm going to, why I'm putting my head down now. The Buddha said what the karma is in your past life which caused you to be reborn ugly in this life. And I have to put my head down so I don't look at anybody when I say this. And why some people are born beautiful in this life. But in particular, in the Mahakamavibhaga Sutta, the Buddha taught the karmic reason why some people are born intelligent and other people are born stupid and dumb. The Buddha taught the karmic cause for being reborn dumb in your next life is not asking questions in this one. So, are there any questions? So it's a great way to get a question. Okay, yeah, thank you.
Well, I was wondering about the sloth and torpor. So you can say, oh, yes, it's time for a nap. And just,
okay, great.
How people work with that one?
How you work with that one? That I've been teaching retreats for many years now. One of the most effective ways of getting deep meditation is when people come up and say the meditation is not working. And this, I have 100% success in this. I tell them to go back to your room, lay down, take a nap. When you get up, have a shower and a cup of tea or something, and then go and meditate. It works every time. People are far too stressed, far too tight, which is one of the reasons why they don't get into deep meditation. As a young monk, and Ajahn Pasno remembers this, we used to get up 3 o'clock in the morning, and I think the first sitting was maybe 3:15, sometimes 3:30 in the morning. I was always very, very tired and very sleepy in that time in the morning. I would fight to get rid of my sloth and torpor. Sometimes you get through it, other times not. When you would fight and get through the sloth and torpor, it would be replaced by restlessness. And so you try and subdue and quieten the restlessness, you go back into sloth and torpor again. It was always like a pendulum going backwards and forwards. At the time I never realized why, but since going to Australia and understanding the way of my mind with greater insight, I understand the cause of sloth and torpor is tiredness. It's old karma. You've been working so hard. In that particular time, we were malnourished. If you look at all the pictures of monks from that time, we were always very, very thin. We were doing without enough sleep. And it was a very, very hot and sticky jungle. You'd expect people to be tired. It was nothing to do with us. It was just nature. So it was the calm of that place. We'd be tired. So, how can you fight nature? Instead of fighting, whenever I'm tired now, I just make peace with it. If you have sloth and torpor, don't fight, make peace. You'll find then that sloth and torpor don't last that long. And when it disappears, it's replaced not with restlessness, but with peace. This beautiful stillness. To be able to understand what's going on, I use the framework, which I said in Spirit Rock last night, about the two parts of the mind. The first part is the active, managing, striving, doing, thinking, reactive mind. I've called that the doer. That part in you which always reacts, manages, controls. The doer mind. The second half of the mind is called the knower, which is the passive one which just is conscious, receives the information, just knows, but does not react. There's two halves of the mind. Describe in completeness what your mind is. The knower and the doer. It's a useful framework because you can understand now where restlessness and where sloth and torpor come from. Because you've been doing so much, thinking, managing, controlling, rushing around, your energy in the mind is so weak, no wonder you're tired. You don't get rid of that tiredness by doing more, by striving, by trying to fight sloth and torpor. In order to fight the sloth and torpor, allow the energy of the mind to flow not into doing more, thinking, worrying, but allow it to flow into just pure knowing. Don't do anything, be patient and wait. Make peace, not war. Make peace with your sloth and torpor. When you do things like that, the energy starts to flow into the knower, and it's not wasted in doing things. After a short time, the mind brightens up, because it's energized, just with the natural energy of the mind, It's not being wasted in fighting. It's all going into knowing. And after a while, the mind just brightens up. Sloth and torpor disappears, and you're left with some peace. And it gets brighter and brighter and brighter as your mindfulness increases in its power. And you know it's increasing in its power when whatever you see more fully, more richly, more deeply. Even looking at the piece of wood in front of you becomes so beautiful, so rich in detail. That's a sign of power mindfulness. It's just like the lights are being turned up in your mind. You see more deeply, more powerfully. You just see more of what's there. And number three, whatever you see with greater happiness. One of the things I discovered in meditation, the more energy you have in the knower, the more joy and happiness you have. It's actually something Ajahn Chah said, I never understood at the time. He said, to get energy in the body, you have to exercise it. To get energy in the mind, you have to be still. The more still you have, the more mental energy you have. The more mental energy you have, the more happiness you have. All coming from stillness. When you're very peaceful and still, the energy just flows into mindfulness. That's why I call it power mindfulness. In the deep meditation, super power mindfulness. And we know what that mindfulness is, you know, just what's needed for enlightenment. Not just the ordinary mindfulness, but the mindfulness empowered by stillness with huge energy and bliss. So that's how you overcome sloth and torpor. Not by fighting, by giving yourself some stillness to increase the energy of the mind. That make sense? There was this, one of the retreats I gave in Sydney a few years ago. One of the retreatants was an executive from Sydney, had a very high stress job. When she came, she arrived late, because, you know, rushing from her job. The first talk I gave was aimed at her. I said, in this retreat, it's the Noble Silence Retreat. I explained what that meant. No bell. So we're not going to have a bell in the morning or a bell in the evening. I said, when you're tired, sleep. When you wake up, meditate. She understood that. So she went to bed. She got up about 7 o'clock just before breakfast, stuffed herself with some breakfast and went back to bed again. She did that for about 3 days, and she told me, and I encouraged her. I said, you've got sleep deficit, you've been in a high profile job, sleep as much as you like until you feel, you know, you got energy again. She was in a dormitory with 3 other women. She said that every day that those women looked at her with just anger. I said, it wasn't anger, it was just jealousy. That's what they want to do, but they haven't got the guts. And so 3 days she hardly meditated at all. And that's how long it took her to overcome her attention and her tiredness. And then the next 3 days she quickly caught up with the rest, and by the end of the 9-day retreat she was way ahead in the depth of her meditation. And I praised her as an example of what to do in your meditation. And I always quote the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the second sermon of the Buddha, which is a powerful teaching, the first teaching which created arahats, fully enlightened beings in the world other than the Buddha, where he said, if this body was yours, you'd be able to control it. Say, oh, may my body be like this, may it be like that. It doesn't belong to you. You can't do that with your body. Leave it alone. It's not your business. It doesn't belong to you. It belongs to nature, not you. Your happiness and suffering doesn't belong to you. The Vedana, now the pleasure and pain, feelings. You can't say, oh, may my feelings be like this, not like that. Even your perceptions, completely conditioned, don't belong to you. Your mental formations, it's not yours. Oh, may my mental formations be like this, not like that. You say, you can't do that, said the Buddha. It doesn't belong to you. And even your consciousness, to say, oh, may my consciousness be like this, be like that. It's not yours, said the Buddha, so you can't do that. Basically, the sloth and torpor is none of your business. So leave it alone. Stop attaching to it and thinking it's for you to control. If you let go of the sloth and torpor, you don't try and control it, it disappears. And you're peaceful and alert and blissed out. That's how you deal with sloth and torpor. Or with anything, basically. Okay. There'd be one person who's going to have an easy life through college when they get reborn, if they get reborn at all. Does anyone else want to be intelligent in their next life? Don't say you've never had the chance. There's going to be lots of dummies in California next lifetime. Next question, please. Yeah, go on.
You had mentioned the executive, and it got me thinking about right livelihood as a concept. And is that considered contradictory to right livelihood? Perhaps it's not a career choice that is doing harm in the world, but it does get in the way of one's pursuit of meditation.
Sure. You're asking about an executive. Does that get in the way of your meditation, your spiritual life? Is it wrong livelihood? You know, sometimes that being an executive is not the problem. It's actually not learning how to balance your life. I'm sure that Ajahn Pasma was told his teaching of how heavy is a cup. Ajahn Chah used to hold a cup up and say, how heavy is this cup? And the answer is, the longer you hold it, the heavier it appears, it seems. If I keep holding this cup for 10 minutes, I'll actually start to be in pain. If I'm holding this cup after half an hour, I'll be in agony. If I'm holding this cup for 2 hours, I'll be a very stupid monk. So what should you do when it starts to get heavy? Put it down. You don't have to throw it away, just put it down for a few minutes, that's all. And then you can pick it up again, and you find it feels lighter. The heaviness is nothing to do with how much water is in your cup. The heaviness is concerned with you don't know how to put it down. When you know how to put things down, from time to time, you can carry a lot of responsibility. There's no problem at all. I never brought my monastery into the United States with me. I've got huge responsibility in Australia. I'm the abbot of a monastery with 21 monks. Spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of West Australia, which is a huge organization. Sometimes you say the spiritual dictator, not the spiritual director, but it's the same thing really. Spiritual advisor of the Buddhist Society of Victoria, Buddhist Society of Victoria, spiritual director of Ajahn Sujata's monastery, Wat Santi, spiritual patron of Bodhikusuma Monastery, spiritual patron of Pumgabok Foundation, that's the place where they send drug addicts in Thailand. Chair monk of the Australia Sangha Association. Spiritual patron of the, Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore. There's about 3,000 members of that one. What else am I? I think that's enough. Yeah. Because I remember once, I was in Singapore, and I gave a talk like this, and this guy came up afterwards and said, look, that's all right for you monks to say that. You don't live in the real world. You know, you just live in a monastery, it's nice and peaceful there. I wasn't going to have that. I wasn't going to stand for that. I told him what I'd done that day. From about 4 o'clock in the morning, when I got up, and then about from 4:30 or 5 o'clock I was working, and it was about 10:30 when he asked that question. I'd been going all day without any rest. I told him everything I did. And he was stunned. He got to the microphone again and he said, I never thought monks work that hard. Before I heard how hard you work, I always thought one day I wanted to become a monk, but not now. I lost one. But the reason why you can work that hard is you know how to put your cup down. So executives, you know, sometimes, I don't mind saying that sometimes I work as hard as any executive, but you know how to put your cup down. Yeah. And that's easy, the schedule. You don't see what I do back in Australia when I get back there. But you know how to put your cup down and rest. So you don't carry the past like coffins on your head. You don't worry about the future. You know that sometimes people like to predict the future. One of my sayings is never trust a poor fortune teller. Makes sense, doesn't it? I don't know, how many of you know that? Sometimes you have these omens, but sometimes you get them wrong. Because there's the story of how many of you know the story of the five angels? Because this happened in Perth not so long ago. This man had a dream. You know, one of these prophetic dreams? He dreamt of five angels, and every angel had five pots of gold. And they lined up to hand him these five pots of gold, 25 pots of gold, worth a fortune. And when he got the last pot of gold, he woke up. He was in his bedroom, it was early morning. He looked around, there was no angels, but even worse, no pots of gold. It was only a dream. But it was a very vivid dream. You have these vivid dreams from time to time. When he went down to the kitchen, or to the breakfast room, he found his wife had made him five boiled eggs and five pieces of toast. It was really weird. He had five angels, five pots of gold, five boiled eggs, five pieces. What's his number five business? Can you imagine what he felt when he looked at the morning newspaper? It was the 5th of May. The 5th day of the 5th month. So he thought this must be an omen. Someone's trying to tell him something. So he looked at the back of the newspaper where you have the sports pages, the horse racing. There's a race course in Perth called Ascot, named after one in UK. ASCOT, five letters. You can imagine what he thought when he looked in race number five. Horse number five was called Five Angels. Wow. This was obviously an omen. So, being a wise guy, he never told his wife. He took the afternoon off work. At lunchtime, he went to the bank to keep the lucky number five. He drew $5,000 out of the bank. You only have these chances once in your life. So he wasn't going to waste it. To keep the lucky number five, $5,000. Even when he went to the racetrack, he chose the fifth, they call it bookmaker, is that the same in the US? The guys who receive the bets for the horses? The fifth in line, to keep the lucky number five. $5,000 on horse number five, race number five, five angels to win. The lucky number five could not be wrong. And it wasn't wrong. The horse came in fifth. Great joke, isn't it? It shows you about sometimes the prophecies. We just misunderstand them, that's all. So don't worry about the future. If you do get a prophecy, you don't know what it means until afterwards.
In the Hindu religion, there's a belief that some of your bad karmas could be offset by doing various good things, various sacrifices in your present life. What is the Buddhist perspective on that?
The Buddhist perspective on karma is well explained by the... this one occasion, when I was, I don't know if it was 17 or 18, or no, 20, 21 or something, I was travelling in Kashmir. And in those days, just going from Jammu into the Srinagar, you had to go over the mountains. And it was only a dirt road, single track, along these incredible precipices. And on one side was a vertical cliff going up, another one, a vertical one going down. And these drivers, they would go like hell around these corners. And every now and again, we'd look down, we'd see a bus, just like us, down the bottom of the ravine. So, I think I was with two Americans at the time, and we complained to the driver, "Please, sir, slow down. It's dangerous." And all the driver said, he was a Muslim. He said, "If it's Allah's will, we go over. It's Allah's will." I said, "I'm not a Muslim." And I sometimes thought afterwards, if we did go over... You know, the Muslim will say it's Allah's will. Christians will say it's Christ's will, or God's will. Maybe a Hindu would say it's karma. What would a Buddhist say? A Buddhist would say it's a bad driver. It's the karma of the present, not the karma of the past, makes you go over. And to understand that, there's a simile which I give of the two people baking a cake. The first person baking a cake has the very worst ingredients possible. They've got white flour. All the goodness has been milled out. In fact, it's so old, it's got mouldy bits in it. Green bits, which you have to take out to get the white stuff to make your cake. They've got cholesterol-enriched butter. Poisonous white sugar. And the fruit which they've got to use is so hard, it's harder than depleted uranium, they could sell it to US military to use as bullets. And they've got a pre-World War kitchen, that's First World War, not the Second World War, to cook it in. They've got the very worst of ingredients. That's person number one. Person number two has got the very best of ingredients. They've got organically grown whole wheat flour, grown in a field without genetically modified crops within 1,000 miles. And they've got trans fat free canola oil. It's called rapeseed oil. It's actually good for you. And they've got honey. Beautiful honey from Redwood Valley. And they've got the most delicious, soft, succulent fruit grown in California. And the best kitchen you could imagine to cook it in. They've got the best possible ingredients. But the question is, who bakes the most delicious cake? The person with the bad ingredients or the person with the beautiful ingredients? It's not always the one with the best ingredients who cooks the most delicious cake. Because ingredients is only a part of what makes a good cake. In fact, the most important part is what you do with those ingredients. How much care, skill, love, if you like, you put into your baking. And I know many people, as you know, who've had terrible ingredients for their life. Who were born not particularly wealthy, maybe not beautiful, not talented. But my goodness, they make a lot of what they've got. Sometimes you can quote, like Nelson Mandela say, born in poverty. I don't think he went to a university. 26 years in jail. What a wonderful person he became. I know other people who've had wealth and privilege, so talented, who've wasted their life in drugs. Most wonderful ingredients, and they made a mess of their cake. The ingredients is the karma from your past. What you have to work with. But the most important part of your life is what you make of the ingredients you have. The karma of the present is more powerful than the karma of the past. So that's basic Buddhism. It tells you what the law of karma is. It explains, you know, your ingredients, why you have what you have. But the most important thing is what you're doing about it. What you're doing with what you have. That's why even, was it hunchbacks? Poor people became fully enlightened. Even Angulimala, the serial killer, became one of these great inspiring teachers. It's what you have with what you've got. And so, you have enough to become fully enlightened, to be the very best of human beings. But it's what you make of what you've got is what's important. That's the law of karma. It explains things, but it never limits you. You never say, oh, it's my bad karma, I can't do anything. Stop complaining. The old Chinese saying says, rather light a candle than complain about darkness. There's always something you can do. And blaming other people, Ajahn Chah said, you know this quote, if you blame someone else, your husband, your wife, your family, if you blame even George Bush, it's like having an itch on your head and you scratch your arse. Or your butt. That's what your choice to say. Complaining or blaming someone else, having an itch on your head and scratching your butt. You just get two itches for the price of one. And it doesn't go away. So stop complaining about others. Do something about it. Does that answer your question, sir? Okay, very good, because that's what you're getting anyway. Just as well. Next question, please. Have we got time? Any other questions? Yeah.
Well, I was just wondering
Ah, yes. Ah, thank you for telling me that question. What happened to those 7 monks when the head monk went along and said, I cannot decide? The answer is, when that head monk explained to all those robbers why he couldn't understand, why he couldn't choose between anybody and what real love meant, all those robbers were so impressed and inspired. Not only did they let all the monks go, but they became monks themselves. And that is actually based, it's an exaggeration, I must admit, but it's based it's based on the story of Adimuttatera, who was a great monk in the time of the Buddha. It's in the Theragata. And this band of thieves wanted to kill him, and he said, I forgive you, whatever you do. He had so much loving kindness. The leader of the thieves was so impressed that all the band of robbers, they stopped being robbers and killers. They let all the monks go. Half of them became monks, the other half just went back to the village. So it's based on a true story. It's only a small exaggeration. I say all the monks, all the robbers became monks. The original story, only half of them became monks. Inspiration is a powerful tool. You know, I don't know if you've had this trouble, but when we first started our monastery in Australia, we didn't have any buildings, but we had lots of building materials, and we only had a wire fence to protect it. We were really afraid of thieves. So Ajahn Jaco asked me to put up a sign, no trespassers will be prosecuted. And I said, that won't work. I had a much better idea. I wrote out this sign, trespassers will be converted. That worked for about 2 weeks until somebody stole my sign. So you've got to think outside the box, as they say. And people are much more afraid of being converted than being prosecuted. But you say you don't convert people that way. You convert people just by inspiring them. And you don't convert them from being a listen to that. You convert them from being sort of a robber, a thief, into being someone who's inspired by goodness and peace and virtue. Yeah.
You said earlier on that you went to Thailand because you found that some Thai priest that you met in England smiled a lot.
Yeah.
So when you went to Thailand, did you see that lots of people there were smiling, happy?
Sure, that was.
And can you make comparison between Thailand and Western countries?
Sure, it was amazing that.
Say whether it has got anything to do with Buddhism.
It has a lot to do with Buddhism, the happiness of people, but. When I went to, say, northeast Thailand, in the villages, not everyone was smiling. Because what I saw was, you know, I went to Cambridge and there were some very wealthy people there, you know, like lords, incredibly wealthy, and also some Nobel laureates. One of the reasons I sort of stopped academia was to find those Nobel laureates. They were brilliant in their field, but they were stupid in life. You know, you got, in the college system, you get to know these people, you socialize with them. The idea is that they get their best ideas from the students, and the students will have a chance to mix with these, you know, elite scientists to give them inspiration. So having mixed with these people, sometimes you find they were going through problems with their marriage, trouble with their children. They were just like everybody else in life. They got Nobel Prizes in physics, but they hadn't got a Nobel Prize in like marriage, which were really counted. So I thought there's something wrong there. But when I went to Thailand, you found that people like Ajahn Chah was the smartest man you ever saw. And he was always happy. And you notice, like in the villages, there were some people were happy, some people were sad. And I soon found out, because in the villages, they always had this water buffalo, which lived underneath the houses. And basically, if you had one water buffalo under your house, and you were content with one water buffalo, they would be smiling. But some villagers had one water buffer, they wanted two. They were poor. It's the same with some of the people I knew in England. They were millionaires, but they wanted the second million. That's why they were poor. It's not what you have makes you rich or poor, it's what you want makes you rich or poor. And you all know that. How many people are rich in this room? Put your hand up if you think you're rich. It's not what you have, it's what you want. You know, Ajit Pasano remembers this, that in our tradition, we're not allowed to accept any money, but sometimes, if you know, you've done a service for somebody, people come up to you, they give you like what's called pawarana, invitation. They say that, you know, you really helped me. Now, is there anything you can get you want for, say, $20? And that's actually allowable to do that. You know, say, Ajahn Pasano, you really helped me. Now, what do you need? You usually specify the amount so people know exactly what you're talking about. And the first time that happened to me, in Wat Nanat Charts, I helped someone, and they said, look, you really helped me. What can I get you for, like, 100 baht? What's that about these days? $3 or something. It was worth a lot of money in Thailand. 100 baht. And I just couldn't think about what I wanted. And he was in a bit of a hurry. He said, I'll come back the next day. And I said, okay, look, I'll think about it tonight and I'll give you, tell you tomorrow. So I went back to my hut, got a piece of paper out and started thinking, what do I need for, you know, 100 baht? And I started writing these things down. After 5 minutes, 100 baht was not enough. And all these things on my list were really important. Another 5 minutes, 1,000 baht wouldn't have been enough. And soon I realized what was going on. And so I screwed up my list. And I told him the next day, give it to the temple, but don't do that to me ever again. I was so content when I never had any means for wanting things. In fact, before you asked me, I'd wanted for nothing. And I like that term, to want for nothing, because that's the way we describe a wealthy person. They want for nothing. And that's the way we describe a rich person. Doesn't matter how much you have, if you want for nothing, then you are wealthy. So as monks, we want for nothing. That's why we're wealthy. We don't want anything. Just a bit of food, that's all we need. Place to stay. So that's what being wealthy is, wanting for nothing. You know the story of the Mexican fisherman? That's a story in my book. Once upon a time, there was this American guy, he was holidaying, vacationing in Mexico. And one day he was just standing by the pier and he saw this fisherman come in. A very pretty, picturesque fishing village. Just before lunch. And this Mexican fisherman unloaded his catch and put it all away, tied it up his boat. And the man came up to him and said, what are you doing? And the Mexican fisherman said, Señor, I've been out all morning. I've caught enough fish now. I'm going to go back home, have lunch with my family, have a siesta after lunch. In the afternoon, I'm going to play with my kids. In the evening after dinner, I go to the cantina. You know, just have a little bit to drink and play guitar with my friends. And that's all I do. Life is good. And the American said, you know, if you don't mind, I'll give you a bit of advice because I'm a professor from business school. He said, go back to lunch, but in the afternoon, go out again. Don't be so lazy. If you go out in the afternoon as well, you get twice as many fish. And if you get twice as many fish, you'll get more money. And so usually, you know, if I give you a proper business plan, after maybe 6 months or a year, you'll be able to buy your second boat. And also be able to hire a crew. With two boats and crew, you can catch, you know, four times as much fish. If you do it this way, after about 3 or 4 years, you'll have your own fleet of boats. And then what you should do is move your business to Mexico City, or even better, to LA. And then you can actually, being the CEO, you can give yourself a very high salary. You float your business on the stock market to capitalize it. And then you do a company buyback. And after a while, you know, you'll be sort of a multimillionaire. That's how it's done in the world. I don't know what I'm talking about, but it's roughly like that. And so a Spanish good fisherman was listening very patiently, and then he said, "But, senor, when I'm a multimillionaire, then what will I do?" And quite surprisingly, the business plans never go that far. And so the professor thought for a while and said, "Actually, well, once you become a multimillionaire, you can retire. You know, retire to, you know, say a nice fishing village like this. Get yourself a little boat. You just go out in the morning just for recreation. You can have lunch with your family every day, have a sleep after lunch, play with your kids every afternoon, in the evening you'll be free to go out to the cantina." "But, senor, I did that already." So the moral of that story is many people want to be wealthy so they can live like poor people. It's true, isn't it, when you think about it that way? So they can have lots of time. So if you're poor already, you're one step ahead of the wealthy people. So what are we doing this for? It's always because wanting, wanting, wanting. Never realize what we want. Or why we're wanting. Just craving for craving's sake. Anything but just to be here and be happy with what we've got. Well, the middle path is, between Hinayana and Mahayana, your relationship with things. To make peace with whatever you've got. In other words, contentment. If you are wealthy, fine. If you're poor, fine. If you're a monk, fine. Just be at peace with what you have. It's called contentment. That's called freedom. Maybe I'll finish off because it's 10 o'clock. It's, how many actually were at Spirit Rock last night? When I, there's only a couple of you. When I told the story about what Nibbana is. It's a very wonderful story and a nice one to finish off with. Because to go back to the origin of this story, was that when I was at school, I was always interested in religion. I thought that's very important to find out the truth of things, but I'd always ask questions. When I asked the chaplain at this school, which I got a scholarship to, I asked him about what God means. And what is this God business which you believe in? It's important to get some understanding of this if you want to be a religious person. So he told me that God is beyond words, ineffable, sort of the ground of all being, the beginning and end of all things, the unmanifest. When he said things like that, it never made any sense to me. So can't you give me something a bit more concrete so I could truly understand what you're talking about? And he couldn't. It's all this words which never had any true meaning. So because of that, I thought the guy never knew what he was talking about. It was just all gobbledygook. And that's one of the reasons why I rejected Christianity. But then when I became a Buddhist, the first monks I met, I started asking them about what Nibbana is. And they said it's beyond words, ineffable, the beginning and ending of everything, the ground of all being. And I said, I've heard that somewhere before. And that never made any sense to me. A lot of times we say this, they're oxymorons. Like, you know, words which you say one after the other, one means one thing, another means the direct opposite. Like crazy wisdom. If you analyze it and look at it, you know, instead of just believing in this stuff, you think about it, you analyze it, you use reason, it doesn't make any sense at all. And that was actually quite frightening, and this is one of the problems with even Buddhists. I gave the simile, it's like getting on a bus, not knowing what the destination is. So, you know, you become a Buddhist, but you know where this is leading? What is this Nibbana you're going to end up in? Do you really know what you're in for? So it's great being able, you know, having great teachers like Ajahn Chah can give you real understanding of what Nibbana actually is. And the greatest story which I have to understand what Nibbana is, which I told last night at Spirit Rock, is the story of the wishing game. Five children were playing the wishing game, which goes like this. If you had a wish, what would it be? and the child with the best wish would win the wishing game. It's a great story to explain what Nibbana is, and everybody can understand it. So the first child said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for a chocolate ice cream. I always change the wish every time. He liked chocolate ice cream, and it was a very hot day. The second child said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for an ice cream factory. Because with an ice cream factory, I don't have one ice cream, and not even chocolate flavour. I can have as many ice creams, every flavour I want, whenever I want it, with my own factory. So the child who just got one chocolate ice cream was very disappointed. He realised he'd lost. So they asked the third child, if you had a wish, what would it be? And the third child said, if I had a wish, I wish for $1 billion. With $1 billion, first of all, I'd buy my own ice cream factory. Number two, I'd buy my own video game store. Then I could play video games whenever I wanted. Third, I'd buy my own school. So I would not need to go there, because I'm too busy playing video games anyway. And I could always give myself the top grades, because I own a school anyway, what the hell? And after, when I graduate from school, then I sell the school and buy a college. that way, and I get my degrees, and it's no trouble at all. And whenever else I think of something I want to buy with $1 billion, that's enough to last you forever. A whole life, you never spend $1 billion. So the poor child with only an ice cream factory thought how stupid I was. And how clever is that one with $1 billion wish? But there were two children left. And the fourth child, he had much more time to think. So he said, if I had a wish, I would wish for 3 wishes. That's a wish. And my first wish, I'll have an ice cream factory. For my second wish, I will have $1 billion. And for my third wish, I will have 3 more wishes. So I can go on forever. And of course the first 3 children thought, how can you ever beat that? An infinity of wishes granted. But there was one child remaining. And the last child became the winner of the wishing game. Managed to express a wish which beat very clearly an infinity of wishes. And that child said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes ever again. I wish I was so content I don't need any more wishes. That's a Buddha describing Nibbana. So content you don't need any more wishes. And that beats an infinity of wishes. Wanting for nothing. Contentment, the end of craving. The highest happiness, Nibbana. So it's a very beautiful story, which explains what you're doing in coming to this temple, this monastery, what the path is, and also what its goal is. And why wishing and wanting, even wishing to get rid of sloth and torpor, or want to get deep meditation, is going in the opposite direction. Contentment, the end of wishes. Nibbana. Okay, so I hope you're content, because that's all you're getting anyway. It's 11 minutes past 10, I have to leave tomorrow morning. So thank you very much, and thank you, Tanajan, for letting me mess around.